Hello, and welcome to the Ryan Lawn and Tree Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Evans, and I'm the Director of Training here at Ryan. I'm an ISA board-certified master arborist with a degree in horticulture from K-State, and I've even been with Ryan Lawn and Tree for over 28 years. I'm thrilled to be providing you with lawn and tree information via this podcast, so thanks for tuning in to this episode. My goal with each episode is to interview experts in the field of lawn and tree care and provide you with the critical and timely information you need to keep your turf, trees, and plants healthy and looking great. For this episode, we could think of no better topic to cover than spring turf care. Our special guest for this episode was Dr. Rodney St. John, a longtime associate here at Ryan. So with that, let's jump in. We are quickly approaching that time of year where Mother Nature starts to come alive, and homeowners get a renewed excitement about their lawn and landscapes. I would like to take a deep dive into what it takes early in the season to have a standout yard. I have several questions for our resident turf expert around the topic of spring turf care, including watering, mowing, crabgrass control, seeding, and a lot more. But first, I'd like to introduce Dr. Rodney St. John. Rodney, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, nice. Thanks for having me, Matt. I'm super excited to be here. First off, a little history about myself. I've been in the lawn landscape or the green industry for over 30 years. Received a PhD in turfgrass science from Iowa State University way back when. Then I was a professor at Kansas State for a number of years before joining Ryan Lawn and Tree about 12 years ago.
Awesome. So as you can see, Dr. Rodney has the credentials to give us the information that we need to make our yards look great this spring. Rodney, the first thing I'd like to start out with is mowing. And we can talk about all different kinds of topics, and I have a list of several things, but is there any key specific things that we need to do around mowing in the spring, and specifically the early part of spring?
Yeah, excellent topic. And it's kind of funny when I tell people that I do have a PhD in turfgrass science, they're like, wow, you have a PhD in mowing? And there's more to dealing with grass than just mowing. But let's talk about mowing because it can get a little confusing for people. So for mowing, the general rule that we usually start with is called the one-third rule, which means never remove more than one-third of the leaf tissue at any one time you mow. So that keeps the grass, your clippings aren't going to be very long. So if you're trying to maintain grass, say, 2 inches high, don't let it grow taller than 3 inches before you mow it. So your clipping will only be 1 inch. So that one-third rule. The interesting part about the one-third rule is that grass changes its growth habit, their growth speed throughout the year. In the springtime, it's growing very, very fast. And in the summertime, it's growing slower when it's so hot. And in the wintertime, it really doesn't grow at all. So in that springtime, if we're following that one-third rule, we might have to mow more than once a week. We might have to mow twice a week or at least every 4 or 5 days to keep that one-third rule in pace. And most people don't think about that, right? I mean, most people think, oh, it's Sunday after church. I go out and mow the yard. I mow it every Sunday. Well, when it's really growing in the springtime, your lawn will benefit from mowing more often and following that one-third rule. Again, it's a guideline. If you can't do it all the time, it's not going to be the end of the world, but that's the best way to do it for your lawn.
Awesome. Another question, too. I've heard recommended that in the spring I should scout my yard.
Yeah.
Can you tell me why I would want to do that, or even if that's a recommended process and what it involves?
Right. And scalp might be not the right best term, because scalp could sound like you're taking the lawnmower and hitting the blade hitting the ground. And that's not what we want to do, but we do want to mow it a little bit shorter. And you don't have to necessarily mow it shorter. To me, it's an appearance thing. Most people are kind of in a contest with their neighbors. I want my yard to look better than my neighbor. And by mowing it shorter, that first mowing of the year, you're removing all the brown leaf tissue that is there from the wintertime and allowing you to see the greener leaf tissue that's coming up from the ground quicker. So it'll make that your lawn looks like it's greening up quicker than your neighbor's yard. I like to keep my yard a little bit on the shorter side over the winter time and in the early spring, because there's a lot of leaves that are blowing around too. And keeping my yard shorter keeps those tree leaves from getting caught in my long shaggy grass, and allows the leaves to either blow onto the neighbor's yard or at least not get caught in my lawn and smother the grass.
Yeah, I kind of do the same thing. I keep it really short so that I can pick up the leaves easier, and if they're blowing, they keep on blowing down the road. So I don't always have that opportunity to mow a lot shorter than what I do. every spring I start out with having my lawnmower serviced. Mm-hmm. So I take it to a Mage small engine. I have them, you know, change the oil and put a new spark plug in, a new air filter, and they sharpen the blade. Is it recommended to sharpen the blade? And if so, is it just in the spring or more often? Or what's your recommendations around blade sharpening?
Yeah, great question. If you read the owner's manual of your lawnmower, most of them will say, you know, you should sharpen your blade with every 8 to 10 hours of use. So for an average homeowner, that could be a couple times a year. If you're talking about a commercial lawn mowing business, they're mowing all day. So they're generally sharpening their blades every night as before they go back out. So I'd be happy if most homeowners sharpened their lawnmower blade once a year. I think that's a great starting point. If you could do it more often than that, great. I always use the analogy of a surgeon, right? It's kind of morbid to think about, but if you're going in for surgery, do you want the surgeon to use a nice clean scalpel or a dull baseball bat? Both are going to get a job done. Not very nice on the baseball bat. So, you know, you want to have a nice sharp blade so that it provides a nice clean cut for the grass. It doesn't injure the grass as much as a big baseball bat would. And then having that clean cut allows that wound to heal quickly and less likely to allow disease and other pathogens to get inside the grass plant.
Well, thank you. There was one other thing that you brought up that I didn't even think about in my notes here that we were going to talk about. But I'm going to deviate a little bit, and we're going to chat about this. So it's this topic of mowing more often in the spring. We want to only take one third off so we keep the plant healthy and we keep a good root system. In the spring, I have a really, really hard time mowing every week. My wife and I both share duties on this. We probably are lucky to get to it once a week. Ryan's does a service for me where they actually spray something on my yard that reduces the amount of growth that happens during that spring flush.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and the benefits to the turf and mowing overall?
Yeah, you bet. It's called a plant growth regulator, and I want to come back to that, or I'll talk about it in a second, but I also want to talk about clippings. So let's talk about clippings after we're done with that. So the plant growth regulator is a liquid application that is sprayed onto the grass, and it slows the growth of the grass. So like I said, in the springtime, grass usually grows very quickly, and by spraying this application down, it can slow the growth of the grass down. Now, it won't prevent you from having to mow. You're still going to have to mow, and I still tell people you should probably still mow once a week. It's not like you're going to be able to skip every, you know, come back every 2 weeks. It's not going to be that kind of a miracle drug. But it, at least when you're mowing once a week, it makes the clippings be manageable so that you can disperse them down. So like when I was saying, you should be mowing maybe every 2 times a week because it's growing so fast. With a mow reducer, you can stick to that once a week schedule and not have to deal with clippings as much.
Perfect.
And with that being said, I would like you to return your clippings as much as you can to the yard. I know at this time of year, well, when the grass starts growing very rapidly, it's almost impossible to always return your clippings. Sometimes you're going to have to bag them and put them in a compost facility. That's fine. But as much as you can, return those clippings to the lawn. Those clippings contain nutrients in there, contain a little bit of moisture in there, and we want to recycle those nutrients and that moisture back into the lawn. So use a mower that can return the clippings. I don't care if that's a side discharge mower, a mulching mower, whatever type of mower, as long as you're returning the clippings to the lawn. My mower is relatively inexpensive, and it doesn't do a good job when I mulch, so I put it on the side chute, and I just let the clippings come out the side because it's not a very good mulching mower. So return the clippings, bag them if you have to, put them in a compost facility if you do, and then always try to keep your clippings out of the street. That's another environmental tip as well. I mean, there's no reason for us to blow all of our grass clippings out in the street. That's just a source of pollution if we're putting grass clippings and nutrients in the street. So keep it in your lawn.
Yeah, I think that's – I'm a huge advocate of returning the clippings back to the yard. There's so much good that comes with them. You know, I'm a arborist, and we like leaves to get back into the the understory underneath the trees. It just adds, it's like a mulch layer. Yep. It is organic matter. It adds moisture. It adds all the good things that plants need. Another thing that I've noticed too is that when I have the grow reducer, the mow reducer, I shouldn't say the grow reducer, although that could be another name for it, applied to my yard, it actually, I almost feel like it makes my yard look better. Is that possible?
Yeah. So what it's doing is it's preventing the cells from elongating. So the cells, each cell in the grass blade are staying shorter and smaller, that means there's a more higher concentration of chlorophyll in each cell. So the grass will actually be a darker shade of green with a mow reducer application on it than without. And then because it's spending more, it's not spending so much energy growing up into the air with long leaves, it's taking that sunlight that it's absorbing and creating carbohydrates from that and using those carbohydrates to grow roots. So a mow reducer can reduce the amount of clippings that you have each time you mow. It can make your lawn darker greener, and then it can actually improve root growth.
Awesome. Thank you. Let's move from mowing.
Okay.
Sounds like we've covered that pretty well.
I think so.
And we'll move on to watering. A lot of us don't think about watering the turf in the spring because Mother Nature provides us a lot of water.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know and get a little bit of feedback on how much we should be putting down in the spring, how often, just your general recommendations around watering.
Yeah, so the guideline for this time of year is to try to water with about an inch of water per week, whether that comes from rainfall or irrigation. And so if it's raining most of the time, you may not have to water a whole lot, especially in the maybe March to April timeframe. We usually get fair rains, although some winters and springs are very, very dry. So an inch of water per week, try to maybe do that over two applications because most of the soils in urban areas are poor soils. You know, they've taken the topsoil off, they've dug a foundation for the home, they take the clay and spread it out over the front yard and the backyard, and so that clay doesn't absorb water very quickly. So spread the watering event out over 2 days and you know, half inch for two applications, get that down 1 inch of water a week.
So I hear a lot of times, and I make these recommendations too, but I never think about it from the client's perspective, an inch of water, a half inch of water, is that an hour on my sprinkler system? Is that 20 minutes on this zone? How do I determine if I've put down an inch or a half an inch of water at each watering?
Great question. I get the same question. Just tell me, how long? Is it 10 minutes, 5 minutes? There's no easy answer for that because every system is different. Whether even if you had the same style of irrigation heads and controllers, everybody has different pressure at their property. So best thing to do is use a rain gauge. Stick a rain gauge out in the middle of wherever you're sprinkling. Run it for a known amount of time, say 30 minutes, and then come out and measure how much water is in the rain gauge. If there's a half inch in there after 30 minutes, then you know you need to run it for 30 minutes to get a half inch. You'll be surprised. It's usually very small amount of water for a long amount of time. Most people are like, oh, I ran my irrigation for 10 minutes. Well, 10 minutes is not a lot of water. Most of the time, you're going to be running a lot of your sprinkler heads way longer than you think you should. Usually a half hour to an hour, maybe 2 hours for some systems.
And that brings up another subject. You talked about doing two waterings versus one watering. What's better, all at once or a little bit every single day? Is there any rhyme or reason to that?
Yeah, the term we would like to use is deeply and infrequently. So water as much water as you can on day one and wait as many days as possible before you irrigate again. And the idea is there, if you were to water a little bit, say an eighth of an inch every day, you could probably have a pretty good lawn. It would look good until it got hot and dry. And the problem with watering real shallow and real frequently, an eighth of an inch every day, for example, then the top quarter of an inch or half inch of the soil is going to stay saturated. And I think most people think about plant roots as, oh, it's the function of plant roots is to absorb moisture out of the ground or to get nutrients out of the ground. They suck the water out of the ground. Well, to do that function, they need air to breathe. And if you're watering every day, then that top, like I said, that top half inch is going to be saturated and you won't be able to get air from above the ground to below the ground. And so the roots will drown essentially, and you'll be left with really, really short roots. And then when it gets hot and dry, you won't be able to irrigate frequently enough because that you're only dealing with a root system that's half inch long, and you'll end up having some trouble with your lawn.
Yeah, watering can get pretty complex when you think about it. It's not just adding moisture, but it's also addressing the gas exchange in the soil as well. And a lot of people don't think about that, so I'm glad that you discussed that.
I like to use the analogy of a sponge, right? So if you take a sponge and you dip it into a bucket and you squeeze all the air out of the sponge, so that sponge is nice and saturated. That's you just applied a whole bunch of water to your lawn. If you press that sponge up against your face, you're going to have a hard time breathing through that sponge. But if I leave that sponge sit on the table for half an hour or a day, it's still going to be moist, but there'll be a lot of air in there. I'll be able to take that sponge and press it against my face and breathe through that sponge and survive. And roots can do the same thing. So deeply and infrequently is the terminology for irrigation that we want to think about.
Great analogy. So we're going to move on to the next topic. So it is spring.
Yep.
I got to fertilize, right?
Yep.
So what are the directions around fertilization? I see Ryan Crews out doing fertilization right now, and it just seems really, really early to me because I'm probably not going to mow for another month. Tell me what you recommend for fertilization and why, as a professional applicator, we can get away with fertilizing something now when actually the grass isn't really going to start growing and responding for maybe a couple weeks to a month or more.
Yeah, that's another great question. So I think let's go back to the basics. If we read a lot of textbooks, they'll say, hey, you should fertilize the bulk of your fertilizer in the fall, and you may or may not need to fertilize in the springtime. We do fertilize in the springtime because that adding that fertilizer in the springtime is going to give you that extra dark green color that most people are looking for, that extra healthiness to the lawn. So while the book may say you may or may not need it, the reason why we're doing it is to provide that extra dark green color that most customers are demanding. So then your next question is, you know, why now? It may seem early. The grass isn't really growing. We haven't started mowing yet. So in a commercial operation, we have a lot of customers to service, and it can take a long time to get all those customer service. So we use some really awesome products. We use this fertilizer that's called a poly-coated fertilizer. So basically take really soluble fertilizer and coat it so that it'll be a very nice, slow, controlled release from the moment we put it down. It won't release any fertilizer the moment we put it down until the soil temperatures warm up enough for the grass to start growing. Once the grass starts growing because the soil temperatures are warm, the fertilizer will start releasing nutrients to the grass. Then it'll slowly feed the grass over the next 6 to 8 weeks. And so that is what's really awesome about our fertilizer and other commercially available fertilizers, is that it can have a nice controlled release. So we can put it down now, and there's no issue with worrying about how it's going to affect the grass plant, because it isn't going to do anything until the grass starts growing.
So interesting. The fertilizer itself has a covering that aligns with the growth pattern of the plant, because as it starts to warm up, the plants start to grow and the fertilizer starts to release because of the coating that's on it. Did I hear that right?
Absolutely. It's really cool stuff.
Kind of mind-blowing
type
of stuff. The other thing that I was thinking of when you brought that up is that that's probably a more environmentally friendly way of applying fertilizer than just applying something that you get at the local box store and dumping it on your yard that doesn't align with the growth pattern of your plant.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I mean, you get what you pay for, right? So expensive fertilizer does nice things. Cheap fertilizer doesn't do good things, right? So exactly the way you described, some of the fertilizer you're going to find at a big box store or at your local garden store probably doesn't have that nice technical professional coating on it that's going to give a nice controlled release. And you're right, we want to use that product because we want to match the nutrient release rate to the growth rate of the grass. If we put down an all soluble fertilizer down now at this time of year, it's going to dissolve. There's a potential for it to leach through the soil. There's a potential for it to run off from the soil and cause environmental harm and environmental impact. By using this coated fertilizer, the nutrient stays there and it's waiting for the grass to use it.
That's awesome. That's really cool stuff.
Yeah.
Must have been developed at NASA or something is my guess. It
probably was.
Another question, we always think about the specific nutrients that we put down when we put down fertilizer.
Right.
Nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, there may be some micronutrients. Is there one thing that we're going after versus another when we're fertilizing a home lawn?
Yeah, I mean, the best thing to do is get a soil test to determine if any nutrients are lacking in your soil. But we've known throughout doing lots of soil tests throughout all of our regions, we generally know where some of those lower nutrient pockets are, and we'll tailor the nutrients, the fertilizer, to those deficiencies. But at this time of year, we're really focused on nitrogen. That's the stuff that makes the grass green. It's a key component for chlorophyll. So the more nitrogen you put down, the darker green the grass is going to get.
Awesome. Thank you. So it looks like we're really going after nitrogen, and the other things probably addressed through a soil test.
Absolutely.
Or the other thing, like you said, too, as a professional, you know your soils.
Right.
As a tree expert, I know I've taken hundreds of soil samples, and I can almost tell you what a soil is around the area based off of the age of the neighborhood. Yep. An older, you know, a Mission Hills type neighborhood might be different than a newer Lenexa type neighborhood. And you know how to kind of mix the nutrients for those certain areas.
Yeah, it all comes, you're absolutely right. To me, it's when I look at the age of the property, if it's a new subdivision that has new homes newly built in the last 5 years or so, again, like we described earlier, they take off that, take the topsoil off, they bring the subsoil up and they spread the subsoil out, and it's generally going to be low in phosphorus and generally low in potassium. And so adding some phosphorus to those yards in those new subdivisions can really help.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, that covers the topic of fertilization. Another thing that I always hear is that when the forsythias bloom, I got to put down my crabgrass control. Is crabgrass control something that everyone should put down? And if so, what is the right timing for that? Because, again, I see our Ryan crews out. I just had my lawn treated probably 2 weeks ago, and then it snowed afterwards. And I haven't seen a forsythia bloom yet. So right. How is it that we can put down well, I know how we can get down the fertilizer. You already explained that to me. But how can I get down the crabgrass pre-emergent and it's not put down on the exact same day that the forsythia blooms and still get good results on my home turf?
Yeah, great questions. Well, let's make sure I come back and answer that question. But I want to go back to the beginning of what is crabgrass preventer and what does it do?
Okay.
Because basically every summer there are going to be a whole host of annual grassy weeds like crabgrass or foxtail that germinate from seed every spring. They grow through the summer and they die in the fall. As soon as the frost comes, they start to die and they disappear from the landscape. And the only way we get more crabgrass next year is for it to come back from seed. So that gives us a unique control opportunity where we can use a thing called a crabgrass preventer, which is essentially an herbicide that we can put down, create a barrier on the soil surface. So as those crabgrass seeds or the foxtail seeds germinate, they absorb a little of that herbicide and then they die and they don't persist in the landscape. So knowing that we have these annual grasses, we can use a crabgrass preventer. And so you asked about the forsythia. If we read articles, books, magazines, whatever, they're going to say, hey, crabgrass seed germinates roughly around the time when the forsythia yellow bush blooms. And so you should put your crabgrass preventer, the crabgrass preventer has to be on the ground before the crabgrass seed germinates. So back to the forsythia. If we have that forsythia bush blooming, we have to have our crabgrass preventer on the ground before that forsythia blooms. So most labels, magazines, again, articles are going to say the forsythia blooming is the best time to put down your crabgrass preventer, right before that forsythia blooms. You asked, how can Ryan Lona Tree get away with putting it down weeks before the forsythia bloom? And it comes back to understanding of the science of how these products work. And so these crabgrass preventers also will break down in response to the temperature of the soil. So if the soil is not warm enough, this product is going to lay there and wait for the soil to start warming up. And then at that point, microbial degradation will start to begin. And so we can put it down even as early as last November for the coming season. Because the soils are cold, the product's going to lay there and do nothing until the soils warm up, and that's when they start to break down. So like the coated fertilizer, you can put it down really early because the coated fertilizer is going to release its nutrients as the soil warms up. With the crabgrass preventer, you can put it down really early because it's not going to break down until the soil starts to warm up.
So it's probably more important to get it down early than to try to wait and time it towards the exact
absolutely
time to do it.
Yeah, if you miss that window by a few days, or if you put the crabgrass preventer down right before the soils warm up and you don't get enough moisture or you don't get enough rain, there might be a possibility that that material doesn't get spread out on the lawn and doesn't get activated, and so you could get some breakthrough and get some crabgrass germination.
And also what I know about forsythias is the flower isn't really dictated by the soil temperature.
Right.
It's actually more the day length, so it's really probably better to follow the soil temperatures and the science of the products that we're using versus trying to time it off of some natural occurrence that we're seeing out in the landscape.
Agreed. And I think the breeders have done a really nice job making forsythia that bloom even longer or earlier. So there's a wide variety of plant material out there that has a wide variety of timing of blooming. So it isn't a very good guideline like it used to be.
Yep. The other thing that has changed over the years that we probably need to talk about, when I was a young man, I worked in a garden center, mm-hmm. and we used to sell crabgrass pre-emergent in the spring. And we would tell people that they could apply one application per year and get great control? I know here at Ryan's we do two applications. Is there a rhyme or a reason why we do two applications versus almost 30 years ago when I was recommended doing one application?
Yeah. Probably the biggest thing that's changed is research, that they've shown that while that was a good recommendation back in the day, and that might have been a recommendation from, you know, a manufacturer saying, hey, this is one easy product, just do it one time. Years of research have shown that if you take that product and split it into two applications, you'll have a much better season-long control at controlling crabgrass and other grassy weeds. So doing a split application is what we and a majority of other professionals are going to do. Even most home programs now are starting to split out that single application into a double application just because it works better.
Awesome. Awesome. Very good information. So I think I got everything right. We got two applications. It can be put down pretty darn early in the season. Another question that I have, so we talked about crabgrass pre-emergent and we talked about fertilizer. Does this mean I'm going to have to make two passes over the yard to get both of these products down? Or how does Ryan's go about doing two applications and how do they get down the fertilizer? My head's just kind of spinning thinking about all this.
Yeah. Well, let's focus on the crabgrass preventer and fertilizer. It's really easy to buy at a box store or us. We're having it custom blended for us where they're taking the fertilizer and putting that crabgrass preventer on the fertilizer. So we do one application in this first round where it is a fertilizer and crabgrass preventer all combination together. You spread it out one time. And then we'll come back in the next round and we'll spray a crabgrass preventer down to bolster that second application that we talked about, a split application being better than one.
Perfect. And I think something that's really important for our listeners to know is that what we do is science.
Yes.
And having someone like you working for the company or working with the company, we know that you're out there harvesting the most important up-to-date scientific information that's out there, which actually helps to get better turf in the long run, correct?
Right, yeah. We're studying different researchers and universities around the country and how they're doing their research to make sure we're doing the right thing for our customers and then conducting our own research as well.
Awesome, awesome. Great information. So if I put I always get this question. If I get crabgrass pre-emergent put on my yard,
why do I still have weeds? Sorry.
You know I was getting ready to ask for that. Why do I still get dandelions in my yard? It's kind of crazy for me to think you all put down a herbicide and I got dandelions popping up in the spring.
Yeah, the key is the word, right? It's crabgrass preventer. So we said crabgrass and other grassy weeds, and that's really what it's doing is preventing grassy weeds, and it has nothing to do with dandelion, clover, violets, you name it, all those other what we call broadleaf weeds. The crabgrass preventer will have no effect on those, and you're going to have to do something different to control those. Would you like to tell me more about, or you want me to tell you more about that?
Yeah, and I'm having a hard time figuring out why I can't get a dandelion pre-emergent put on my yard. Why wouldn't you just do that so I don't get a dandelion?
Chemistry. It's not available. There isn't a tool. There are tools available for landscape beds. They're just not cost effective. That's the main thing. They're not cost effective for a lawn or even a landscape situation. It is way easier to use a liquid material and spray over the top of that actively growing dandelion than it is to use the products that could preventively control dandelion. It's easier to kill them when they're young and small than it is to try to prevent them.
So let me get this straight, Rodney. I'm putting down a pre-emergent early for grassy type weeds, and I'm putting down something else for broadleaf weeds, our dandelions, our clover, our henbit, all of that type of stuff. What does that entail? Is that another granular application? How do I get rid of those weeds?
Yeah, what we do and what I recommend for even homeowners to do is a liquid application.
Okay.
You will find at your, you know, five-step program that you buy in a bag from a store, it's going to possibly be a granular weed and feed type of application. They're okay. They're not going to be effective because the idea with a weed and feed, they're taking the broadleaf herbicide and sticking it on a granular fertilizer or a granule of fertilizer, and then that granule has to get close enough or onto the weed that you're having issues with. So trying to get good coverage with a granular product is really, really hard to control broadleaf weeds like that. So I always recommend using a liquid application.
Yeah, and this is one thing I've talked to homeowners about before. We have a lot of homeowners that are do-it-yourselfers. and of a lawn care program, to me, it seems like the easiest thing is probably getting a small spreader and putting down the fertilizer, the pre-emergent yourself. Talk to me a little bit about how difficult it is and what specialized equipment you need to actually spray the lawn. And I'm bringing this up because a lot of times when I talk to a do-it-yourself, I recommend that they do this part through a professional versus doing it themselves.
Yeah, and it comes down to math and measuring, right? I mean, you're dealing with concentrated products, and you're trying to measure out small amounts of that concentrated product and spread it out over a large area. And if you screw it up, you could screw stuff up pretty quickly. So I think it's just best to hire a professional when you're dealing with liquid applications, because it is harder to measure and get an exact measurement. The other thing is, if you're not doing it yourself and you're buying some already made products at your box store, you're spending a lot of money on water to get that product diluted properly to put on your yard. So I would just do it. Just hire somebody to do it.
Awesome.
A lot easier.
Awesome. Thank you. The last thing that we probably need to discuss, it is spring. My yard doesn't look good. Let's say it's thin. It's got bare areas. Is this a great time to seed, or is it not a great time to seed? Speak to me a little bit about that. Is it spring, fall? Is it, I've heard both. What do I need to do? And what kind of results can I expect from spring seeding?
Yeah, I'll give you my favorite answer to every question that people ask about turf is, well, it depends, Matt. So let me start with saying this. If you're going to go and choose a time for the best time of year to seed a lawn, fall is going to be the best time to seed a lawn. And the idea there, and we're talking about cool season grasses, okay, like tall fescue and Kentucky bluegrass and perennial ryegrass, because if we seed in the fall, we'll have all of the fall, all of the winter, and all of the spring to get that grass healthy and mature before next summertime comes. And that's when the stress is really going to hammer those cool season grasses. So we have 9 months or so to get the grass mature. Excellent. With that being said, the second best time to seed is whenever you have bare spots, right? I mean, I don't want you to leave a bare spot in your yard in the springtime because Rod said wait till the fall. If you want to, you know, maximize and you can tolerate it, it's great. But I would rather you seed and try to get some lawn established into those bare soils rather than leave an open soil spot where more weeds can grow or more soil can erode and cause more problems down the line. So seed whenever you can. I think you're going to see a lot of commercials with this time of year. I think when people, you know, the trees are starting to bloom, or flowers are blooming and trees are leafing out, right? Everything seems green and alive. Everybody wants to seed. So you'll see commercials for seeding. If you don't have to seed, don't. But fall is the best time to seed, and spring is the next best time. Just realize if you do seed in the spring, your biggest headache is going to be the summer. So you're going to have to baby that grass and take a little bit better care of it than you would a fall seeded lawn. You're going to have to water it more frequently and keep it damp because it's going to stress out because the root system's not going to be mature.
So let's talk a little more science here again. I have heard that I can use a crabgrass pre-emergent, which slows down or stops grassy type weeds from growing in the spring, and seed at the same time. Did I hear that correctly? And if so, can you walk me through how I can actually put down a pre-emergent, a broadleaf weed pre-emergent, and still get my grass seed to grow in the spring? Is that possible, or did I hear something incorrectly?
Yes and no. So it depends on what grass you're dealing with. Tall fescue and perennial ryegrass are much larger seeds, so they can have the ability to power through that herbicide layer better than Kentucky bluegrass. So Kentucky bluegrass, I wouldn't recommend it. I'll go back and I'll say this first. I'll say if you can choose whether or not you put your pre-emergent down, your crabgrass preventer, and seed, you know, choose not to put your crabgrass preventer down. It would be better to just seed into a bare soil situation. If you get into a situation where you put down your crabgrass preventer and you go, oh, man, I wanted to seed. With tall fescue and perennial ryegrass, research has shown that you can get about 70% of that grass seed to germinate through that herbicide layer. So let me state this again the same way, a different way.
Okay.
If you have your choice, please don't put a pre-emergent down wherever you want to seed. If you don't have a choice, or if you forgot, or if you just want to, you will have some success getting that seed to germinate through that crabgrass preventer layer, especially the tall fescue and perennial ryegrass seeds.
Perfect. Before we close this out, there's one question I've got around the topic of weed control.
Mm-hmm.
What is We've talked about broadleaf weed control. We've talked about grassy weed control. What is the best defense against having weeds in your home lawn?
You've been watching some of my presentations.
I have been watching them.
And that's one of my favorite sayings, is to say the best defense or the first defense against weeds is thick, healthy turf. You know, when we talk about crabgrass, we didn't really get into it here in this conversation, but I told you how crabgrass seed germinates from seed in the springtime, grows over the summer, dies in the fall, and then has to come back from seed in the spring. Well, to get any seed to germinate, your vegetable garden, a tree, a grass, what does it need to germinate? What are the two things? It needs moisture.
It needs moisture. It needs warmth. It probably needs sunlight.
Sunlight. Yeah. Sunlight being one of the key things right there. So if we're talking about a thick, healthy lawn that has nice, thick, super dense grass blades all packed close together, the odds of sunlight getting to the soil surface is not very high. And so by keeping the lawn super thick and dense, we can eliminate or reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the soil surface, which prevents weed seeds from germinating. It's not going to prevent all weed seeds from germinating, but it's going to be that first best defense against weeds is thick, healthy turf.
And that's something I always like to bring up, especially on the tree side. And I know it plays into the turf side as well, is that as like humans, if I'm healthy and eat right and get my sleep, I tend to be sick less.
Correct.
And the same thing holds true for plants. If we can nurture them and care for their needs by returning the clippings and adding organic matter and aerating and watering properly and getting the right amount of sunlight, a lot of these products we can use less of, or in some situations, maybe not at all. And we can actually be better stewards of the environment just by having healthier, happier, better looking trees and shrubs.
Yep. Irrigate it properly, mow it properly, feed it with fertilizer. Absolutely.
I think as humans, we look for the easy button sometimes. And
I like it.
Those things aren't as easy, but it definitely is something we need to talk about because we're trying to have a really good looking turf.
Yes, sir.
And beat Mrs. Jones down the street for
exactly.
Sure. So that's all I've got for today. I'd like to thank Dr. Rodney St. John for being with us today. And hopefully you'll be able to join us in the future.
I'd love to.
For maybe some disease talk this summer.
Sounds fantastic.
All right. Thanks, Rodney.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ryan Lawn and Tree Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to show your support, please like, share, and subscribe. And if you're interested in having one of our turf experts take care of your lawn, please reach out to us at ryanlawn.com, and we would be happy to have one of our turf managers come out and give you a free estimate. And also, a little secret, we're offering 50% off your first application. Visit us at ryanlawn.com.